Hi, it's Dennis Green on KCCK, and in our kind of continuing series of interviews during the pandemic, we're just kind of grabbing artists from not only around Iowa, but all around the country over Zoom to talk about their careers and projects and things like that. Now it's my pleasure to welcome someone who's no stranger to the KCCK airwaves as a guest interview subject or playing his music or whatever. It's Jim Dreyer from Iowa City, drummer and founder of the Salsa Band and James Dreyer's Ritmo Cano, the Beaker Brothers, so many, many other bands. We'll get to that as we go. First off, Jim, welcome. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you, Dennis. I'm very happy to be joining you today.
And the reason, not that I need a reason to interview Jim Dreyer on KCCK ever, but the occasion that brought this one to the fore was because earlier this year you were named to the Iowa Jazz Educators Hall of Fame, and it's the highest honor that a jazz educator can receive in the state of Iowa. And you join many, many friends and mentors. Mm-hmm. I was looking over the list and I was thinking these are people that you have worked with and performed with and collaborated with. Bob Washit from the University of Northern Iowa, John Rapson, your friend Al Naylor, and and many, many others. So before we go any further, talk to me a little bit about what it feels like to be a part of that group.
Well, of course, I am honored, and it's very gratifying to be recognized by people like the folks that you just mentioned and many of the other great jazz educators around Iowa. So, of course, it's a wonderful honor. And I, of course, I'm always feeling like, you know, what I do and the kind of work that I do is so, I'm blessed to have the kind of work that I have. And teaching at the University of Iowa in the jazz department with the people that I work with and teaching the classes that I do and getting to go around and work with high school jazz bands and especially with my work with Latin jazz. These are things that I love doing, and it's not hard for me to do that work. So in a way, I feel like I'm being recognized for doing something that's really, you know, enjoyable for me. And it's not that I have to work that. I mean, I've done a lot of work in my, you know, to get to where I am, and I work hard at the University of Iowa and all that stuff, but I always am recognizing the folks to me who are really in the trenches, and that's the high school band directors that get up at, you know, 5:30 in the morning, 6 o'clock in the morning to have a before school jazz band rehearsal in maybe some small rural community that may never get recognized, or they struggle with funding, or maybe don't have quite the support. And but you've got really good-hearted, good-intentioned people out there working really hard. That to me are really the heroes of the jazz education in Iowa. So I take it with great humility and appreciation, but also with a grain of salt, knowing that you know the people that are that I believe are really doing the frontline hard work are junior high school band directors, where jazz band is just one of the things that they do, and their plate is so full, but yet they do the extra work oftentimes and so many times get great results. Our jazz, as you know, Dennis, I mean, that's one of the things that surprises people when they come to Iowa is the quality of our jazz education in public schools in Iowa. It's really phenomenal. And it's ironic that in this relatively white state that we have such a strong jazz history of jazz education.
Growing up in Cedar Falls, did you have mentors in your own early band years that helped set you on this course?
I did, but you know, my history is a little unique because when I was in school, and this dates me because, you know, I'm old, we didn't have a jazz band at that time. I went to campus school and I graduated in 1970. I actually wasn't even in orchestra or band. I tried to get into band, but they said they had too many snare drummers, so they wouldn't let anybody else in. And so I was self-taught for many years, and actually started playing in bands in high school. When I was in high school, I started playing professionally with soul bands and things like that. But then I did have mentors, people that I interacted with who were jazz musicians that were also rock musicians. So I would be in bands with them. Two of those people would be Mike Anderson and Craig Kelly, a drummer. Craig Kelly played with me in a band much like the Beaker Brothers is. It was a two-drum band that played a lot of Allman Brothers in 1973, 74, something like that. And he was a jazz drummer, and he started showing me jazz beats and stuff. And I thought, wow, maybe I can do this. And at the same time, the Chick Corea Light as a Feather album came out. And before that, it was really hard for me to hear jazz. I knew it was good, hadn't really made that connection until I heard Ayrto playing with Chick Corea, and that kind of electric Brazilian sound really attracted my ear. And that was my doorway. Then after that, I started playing jazz a little bit. I started getting more recordings of that kind. And then I started to develop more of an ear for the other jazz that I couldn't have heard before. And then eventually I found myself at Berklee College of Music and pretty well, entrenched in a study of jazz.
Well, fast forward to you're out of Berklee, you're back in Iowa, and and trying to make it as a teacher and a musician, and I'm sure playing in lots of bands. And then Bob Washit and Ed East have this crazy idea of starting a Latin jazz band in the middle of Iowa.
Yeah, I was just lucky to be back in Iowa. That was in 86. And before my daughter was born was our first gig at the College Hill Arts Festival. And Bob called me because I'd met him before when we came back to visit. My parents lived in Cedar Falls. And of course I grew up there, but we came back to visit the summer before and I got to know Bob and played a little bit. 1986 was our first gig, and we were horrible. We couldn't get made it through one or two tunes without getting lost rhythmically. I mean, but to our surprise, everybody loved it. And it was the only band I've ever been in, really, where the music itself propelled the band to get better. In other words, we were popular before we should have been because the music was so attractive that we were playing. And so the more we played, the more we were incentivized to get better because we were representing this music and we were trying to learn it ourselves. And so it was a fantastic place for me to learn the music and play it. It was invaluable, really, because I got to play everything, a little bit of all the percussion. We would switch around and we played all kinds of styles. And then I began going to Brazil and Cuba and studying more and getting into it. But having that band as my laboratory, I couldn't have done that kind of immersion into Latin music without it.
Amiga. pastorita tiene guarare conmigo. Yo no sé por qué será. Pastorita tiene guarare conmigo. Yo no sé por qué será.
Experience with Orquesta Alta Maíz and your continued interest in and passion for Latin music has enabled you to travel the world. You mentioned Brazil and Cuba in particular. Mm-hmm. Talk to me in particular about going to Cuba to study the music, because at the time that you started going to Cuba, that was a time when it was not easy to do. Very few Americans got to go there and do anything, and you had to have an educational purpose in order to go.
Our first trip was 2001. And then we took students down in 2003 from the University of Iowa. And that's when the Iraq War started. And then it got very difficult again. Went back in 2009 with just the directors and teachers from the Afro-Cuban Drum and Dance Ensemble at the University of Iowa with Paul Cunliffe. And then the last time was just 2 years ago with the University of Iowa. Again, we were able to take students down through the, with my colleague at the university, Dimi Dureska, from the entrepreneurship part of the business school, and with music students. And a lot of my Latin jazz ensemble students went. And that was fantastic. So, I mean, it was very interesting. It's been interesting to see the difference in Cuba through the years, how it's evolved and how it hasn't, how the, you know, how some things have changed. And it's been very interesting. But every single trip is a gold mine of information and so very valuable.
I'm sure that the first time that you went, or the first time whenever you take somebody new to Cuba, and I've been to Cuba too, so you know, speak from a little bit of experience. You go in thinking, and I, especially with you as a musician, you probably have feel like a little bit of an imposter, because you're going to take a class and expose yourself to the musicians who invented all of this. But I'll bet that they are excited that you are so interested in their music.
It's really interesting, because the first time, the first two times we went, which were pretty close together, 2001 and 3, we studied with a very famous rumba group from Matanzas, which is the sort of the New Orleans of Cuba. It's the place that has the most West African influences. It's where the Africans were brought in to be enslaved workers in Cuba. It's the port city. So they have this incredible heritage of Afro folkloric music. And the Los Muñequitos de Matanzas is a very, very famous rumba group that's been around since the 50s. It's very family, you know, the group stays together with in a family kind of way. So the sons continue it on with their fathers did before, et cetera. So we had this world class. We went in for classes and just kind of set up. We go up to their studio, and there were a bunch of, you know, people from Iowa, students and us, the teachers. And it was not only drumming and percussion, but dance classes that we had to take. So now we're learning these, like, we're taking these hours long dance classes up in this top floor of an air conditioned, you know, Cuban Matanzas studio. But it's like the Muñequitos are playing our dance class, which is crazy. It's like, you know, it'd be like having the, you know, Miles Davis quintet playing for your improvisation class or something. It's just, it was so, you know, I felt almost ridiculous. It's like, I'm here are these awkward people trying to dance. And of course our dance students were really great, but it was pretty amazing. And here's what would happen every time. They would come in late every time, because time in Cuba, as you probably found out, is a different thing there than a westernized European thing. It's more like a suggestion. So the 10 a.m. class, you know, maybe it was 10 to noon dance class. Wander in, kind of hang out, talk, have a few sips of rum, 10:30, 10:45. Finally, when it felt right, the dancer instructor, we'd start. And then the rhythms would start and the energy would begin to build. And then you would see them smiling at each other, the drummers. And pretty soon a groove would build and they'd be looking at each other and they'd be having fun. And you have to remember, they do this at that time. They were doing this every day, every week, months in and months out, except for when they're out touring. That's how they made their living. These groups would come in from Canada, United States, and take classes. So this is something they did all the time, but yet when they got into it, they were totally into it. And the groove was just outrageous. And always they would say at the end, you know, we give you this information and for you to share it when you go back to the United States, but do it authentically. They were very, very concerned that we teach this the correct way as we taught it, as we learned it. So there's this very huge amount of pride and identity in the music that they, this Afro-Cuban music that was such an important part of Cuba. And they were very, very, very determined that we present it authentically.
Thank you.
since the timing of our conversation is about you being honored as the 2020 honoree of the Jazz Educators of Iowa Hall of Fame, and you've talked about being a student in Cuba and learning the music from the musicians who, you know, who it's a part of their culture. From the guest artist perspective, when you are going in, you know, either as a guest artist or maybe doing some adjudication, what are you trying to get across when you're interacting with the students? I mean, obviously there are musical tasks that you are trying to accomplish, but at the same time, I'm sure you are looking at them and thinking, I hope that through this experience, you will get some of the same passion for music that I had when I was your age.
It depends on the context. If I'm doing an adjudication gig at a jazz festival and I only have 10 or 15 minutes to go up and work with a band, and I try to be real specific about a few things. Or if I have a 2-hour clinic with a group, then I might be working by myself or somebody else. So those all shape the context. But a couple of things that you mentioned that I do try to, because, you know, students can sort of get it, you know, it's a class. It's part of they don't appreciate it a lot because the age, and it's just a class that they do. And, you know, it's a part of their busy day, and they're involved in about, you know, 10 other out of school activities. So I always try to, at the beginning of any, if I say I haven't worked with a band for a couple hours, I congratulate them and try to make them understand how awesome it is that they are involved in jazz. And I try to give them a little bit of a idea of how important jazz is as a musical style to their American culture. And I try to reference and make them understand that it came from the African-American experience, that it's an African-American derived music, and that it comes from a very complicated and difficult part of American history. At the same time, it's very inclusive and joyful. I try to make them feel like they're special, because I think they are. I say, you're here at 7 o'clock in the morning. You don't have to be here. Your parents drove you here. They didn't have to do that. Yeah, I think it's awesome that you are dedicating some of your time to be involved in this music. And it's important that you understand that. And maybe it'll help you get up and get to school if you understand that this is a really important part of your legacy. Even though it came from a part of American history that is so far away from Mid Prairie High School in the middle of Iowa at 7 o'clock in the morning. But to me, that's fantastic. I love that irony in a way, or that the dichotomy of that to me, that speaks to the power of jazz.
We've talked a lot about your work in Latin jazz bands, of course, Orquesta Alta Maíz, your own project, James Dreyer's Ritmo Cano, which is, which I think we could do another half hour on that. But of course, you've also played, traditional jazz in, mm-hmm. in a variety of groups, just as much as you've done Latin jazz. But Absolutely. You kind of have, in the last decade, have kind of gone back to your roots. And let's talk about the Beaker Brothers for a minute, because when you talk about jazz educators, gotten into some kind of heady stuff. But it sounds like when I watch the Beaker Brothers, and as you know, I'm a big fan and come and see the band and listen to the band a lot, what I see is everybody really just casting everything aside and just playing for the sheer joy of it.
Well, we're in a very unique situation. I mentioned earlier in the interview how I played in a band like the Beaker Brothers in 1973. I am playing the music that I basically grew up on. At that time, in the late 60s and early 70s, rock and roll was very exploratory, and long jam sessions or jam sections were almost required. It's like, if a tune wasn't 12 minutes long, it's like, why even play it? So in a lot of ways, I played in a band called Bamboo, and from 1970 to 72, I learned a lot about improvisation in that band, because we would have we would just go wherever it went. It helped me learn how to improvise. And it wasn't jazz, but a lot of the fundamentals of improvisation I really had a chance to work with. That is very much what we do in the Beaker Brothers. So we've got this combination of many, many years of playing music of all kinds, but we're playing music of our youth, all of us, except for our new keyboard player who has an old soul, but he's not as old in years as we are, but he's fantastic, Bill Peterson. And of course, John Schultz was one of our founding members, and you know, we love John to miss him dearly. I think of him all the time, especially when we're playing. I feel him. I feel him watching us. I think the combination of a lot of experience playing this music again, which is a gift. I didn't think I'd be able to play rock and roll Hoochie Coo and Jumpin' Jack Flash and Oye Como Va again. We're dear friends. We have a blast playing together, and it's, you know, as long as we can make it happen, we'll make it happen. But I think this sort of separation of styles sometimes is a little bit overstated, because a lot of the idea of improvisation and dynamics and phrasing and, you know, shaping solos, it's all the same no matter what style you're in. And I think when you play as a musician, you, especially as a jazz musician, and this is something I also try to tell students that are interested in jazz, is that when you're playing jazz, especially, I think, because it's such an expressive music, you're playing your life for everybody to see up to that point. It's a snapshot of everything you've done. So I mean, just me hitting the ride cymbal like three times is an indication of the millions of times I've ever hit that ride cymbal. And another drummer will hit a ride cymbal and it'll sound a little different. So I think, you know, all music is like this, but I think jazz is really like this, where it really shows your whole life experience, all your influences, even if it's very subtle. If I'm playing a swing tune, you're going to hear Santana in there. You're going to hear some rock. You're going to hear my Latin. You're going to hear sort of odd bar jazz stuff that I did with Stephen Brandt, and you know, everything's in there, is my point. And I think if you get students to listen to jazz that way, it makes it a little bit more interesting. Younger players, they don't have quite that depth of experience yet. They may be technically proficient, but you're going to hear their life up to that point. When you hear an older musician, you're hearing a lot of history in that playing. I think that's a really cool thing.
Jim, congratulations again on being named the 2020 inductee into the Jazz Educators of Iowa Hall of Fame. And of course, as the pandemic progresses, trying to figure out ways to get music out there and watch live music. And I know that the Beakers are trying to get out there where and when it's safe. And I know that you're also hip deep in trying to figure out how to teach your classes and keep everything going.
It's a crazy time. It really is. And who knows what's going to happen this fall, but we're trying to get prepared for whatever comes our way. I feel, again, University of Iowa is going through some tough times, but to me, it's the public schools that are, again, on the front and center and in the trenches, and I'm really concerned about the fall and what's going to happen.
Well, with educators like you working with the students and working with other teachers, you know, it may take us a while to get back to where we were, but the outcome, I know, will be positive. Jim Dreyer, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Dennis. I appreciate the opportunity.
And as we close, let's hear Jim play his life with something from the Beaker Brothers recorded live on KCCK a few years ago at Jazz Under the Stars. Jim, thanks again.
Thank you, Dennis.
Mulata, oye, ¿cómo va?
Chief Chris Moore.
Wonderful night on the park.